Thank you for the introduction. First of all, I want to thank all the conference coordinators for the kind invitation and for allowing me to speak here in this conference. And of course, I also want to thank the usual wonderful hospitality at the KITP and the, you know, excellent and very nice you know, interchange environment. For some time we have been looking into studying and proposing some ways in which you could manipulate static lattice deformations in graphene to affect electronic transport or to manipulate the way that electrons behave in graphene with possible applications in transport, spectroscopy, chemical reactivity, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this today, and with some slight special emphasis on the current experimental prospects for this concept of strain-engineered graphene to come to full fruition. Okay, so these are my collaborators in several of the, you know, problems that we addressed. Different combinations of these people have entered in different problems, but there is definitely a strong overlap with Antonio and with Nuno, both at NUS in Singapore, at the Graphene Center now as well. So I guess straight to the topic, when I mean, or one talks about using strain to manipulate or to influence the electronic structure in graphene, one of course is invoking the interplay between lattice deformations and electronic degrees of freedom. And in the case of graphene, this comes up in many different scenarios, some of them which are not usual at all in condensed matter physics. Of course, we have the more conventional situations where you have, you know, when you want to describe electron-phonon processes or scattering by topological lattice defects and so on and so forth. These are more conventional in the sense that these are things that occur in any crystal, and so they of course occur in graphene as well. But one starts seeing some peculiarities depending on the incarnation of graphene that you have. So for example, there are aspects which are intrinsic to some realizations of graphene, which you cannot avoid at all if you want to correctly describe the electronic structure. So for example, you know, in the case of nanotubes, you have to consider curvature to correctly describe the electronic structure because you have rehybridization of the pi orbitals. That's one aspect of it. And in fullerenes, you have, you know, in addition to curvature, you have topological defects, because that's the only way you have to, you can have a closed, you know, graphene cage. So in plain graphene, the situation is even more interesting in the sense that now you have a free membrane. And therefore, there are other issues which usually don't arise in solid-state physics or conventional semiconductors, at least. And for example, you know, it has been widely discussed that the fact that you might have ripples, which could be dynamic or static, definitely contributes some random gauge fields, and this can have consequences for unusual aspects of localization of Dirac fermions in graphene. Again, since you have this two-dimensional system in free space, you can easily imagine situations where you can have Dirac fermions in non-conventional textures, in the sense that you have, you know, now you have a third direction to play with. You can have curved membranes. You can have situations like this, and this there is a strong connection that you can make here in this context with some realizations of quantum field theory in curved spaces. And Maria yesterday gave a very nice overview and talk about some of these issues. There are wrinkles as well in, you know, conventional graphene samples. There's also an interesting fact that since this is just one atom thick, essentially you can basically neglect gravity, there are also dynamic feedback, so between the electrons and the phonons now, which means that you can have the fact that your electrons are interacting with the phonons, especially flexor phonons and so on, can lead to this feedback in which you can, instead of just static deformations influencing your electronic dispersion and electronic aspects, you can also have the electron screening properties and so on, inducing deformations in the lattice dynamically. This has been discussed by people here in the audience. Doran, for example, Gazi discussed it. Eros Mariani and Marco Polini also made some comments about that. And of course, I have to acknowledge that our chairman Paco and Maria Mosvediani are, of course, prominent players in this field. They have basically addressed all, you know, of each one of these aspects in some way or the other, even way well before graphene was isolated in the context of the fullerenes and nanotubes and so on and so forth. So I certainly acknowledge that. The idea to use a strain here is that instead of, in a sense, surrender to the fact that depending on the specific graphene realization that you have, or depending on your experimental conditions, which might lead to ripples, wrinkles, and things like this, which you might think are detrimental to electronic physics in graphene, the idea is actually to harness the richness of the ways in which you can, these 2 degrees of freedom can be manipulated, and try to use that to our advantage. And that's possible, and essentially can be realizable, essentially because of 2 important aspects. One of them is that we're talking about carbon, and the second one is the 2-dimensionality of the system. Carbon, because it leads to the most robust bonding in nature, this sigma bond in carbon. So you have a membrane which is not, you know, flimsy in the sense that, you know, you do anything and it just starts ripping. That's totally the opposite case. And then you have this 2-dimensional crystalline membrane, which has no bulk, essentially. And you have, this means that you have a 2-dimensional electronic system, which you can fully manipulate in this embedded 3D space. And this, you know, introduces many new ways in which you can interact with it. So these to me are 2 key aspects of which motivate these ideas. Of course, one can ask why strain and why graphene, or what's so special about graphene, and that we cannot use or we don't talk about or don't have these ideas in other systems. So several reasons. So for example, essentially the most important one is the fact that graphene is the strongest material ever measured, in the sense that in plane Young modulus is very high, and it's very resistant to strain. So we can be stretched to very large values and relax elastically without introducing defects in the lattice and so on and so forth. And technically, it's also important that it is a simple system, and so it's accurately modeled. So you can model the way in which, by using atomistic potentials and so on and so forth, you can model with good accuracy the way in which graphene relaxes to certain strains and boundary conditions and so on and so forth. And now it's now famous, this aspect that the way that electrons couple to deformations in graphene lead to this so-called effective pseudomagnetic fields, which have been recently shown that, you know, they can be of the order of hundreds of Tesla. And so this opens the prospect of for very, you know, some interesting, perhaps, new physics that could be studied under such effective magnetic fields. And of course, strain by itself, it's important for some applications which, you know, are technologically seeked and needed currently in the context of transparent and flexible electronics and so on and so forth. So strain could be something that, and since graphene is so thin and transparent and it could be used for these flexible transparent displays and touch screens and so on, strain can be something which one has to deal in real applications in real life for some applications. Also people started to be interested in this concept of strain engineering, and this is just some brief numbers. You know, there's some last APS meeting. There was there's a lot of interest in strain graphene. So there were three sessions just dedicated to strain graphene, and in 2012 it was roughly the same. In terms of publications, there is essentially an explosion around 2007, and we have a number of papers coming now every year on the subject. So experimentally, the basic elastic properties of graphene are well characterized by now, in my opinion. It has been established that it is indeed the strongest material in nature in that sense that it has these in-plane Young modules of 1 terapascal and can be deformed to values between 10 and 20%, and it's even impermeable to gases. So you can make you can induce strain by making nano balloons, which is quite cool in my opinion. There was also lots of action around Raman spectroscopy in strain graphene. This turns out to be actually important from a practical point of view, because you could use Raman, you know, under strain, the Raman peak is displaced. You can have splitting or shift or both of the Raman resonances, and by knowing how much this shift is for a given amount of strain, you could then use Raman, which is non-invasive, and it basically don't need to do anything, just need a sample, and it's a very simple technique to measure and detect whether your sample is strained or if you have the strain profile that you want. Okay, from the electronic point of view, it's really simple to understand what the basics of what strain causes. Essentially, when you deform arbitrarily graphene, your nearest neighbor atoms, can take arbitrary positions and distances from each other than they were initially. So, assuming that you have a deformation which is arbitrary but still uniform in the sense that you still have translation invariance, then you can still write an energy dispersion. But now it's more general because the hoppings can be all different and these deltas can be all different in different lengths and so on. And Asagawa and collaborators have shown that this dispersion is quite robust, and the fact that the spectrum is gapless and you have a Dirac cone is quite robust. If you wanted to generate a gap by straining graphene, in other words, by changing these hoppings, you'd have to deform this system a lot. This is illustrated here in this sort of phase diagram where you plot one hopping against the other hopping, and there is this isotropic point, and you'd have, if there is a big region of parameter space where the system remains gapless, and only by changing one of the hoppings with respect to some of the other by a large amount, you can go to the gapful regime. This can be quantified precisely, and when you do that, you find out that, for example, the threshold deformation to do that is of the order of 20%, which is enormous. And the reason for that is that when you're straining, what's happening is that, or when you're changing these hoppings, for example, you're deforming your Fermi surface, or you're deforming your band dispersion. And one thing that happens is that, in general, the Dirac cones will merge, will be displaced, and they will merge toward each other. And of course, if they merge, you have the topology of the Fermi surface will change. You have a lifted transition, and obviously you get a gap. But you see, the fact that the gap comes about because of the merging of the K and K prime point means that you have to deform so much that the Dirac point essentially moved from one edge of the corner of the Brillouin zone to the other one. So that's why you need a huge deformation of 20%. Other than that, if the situation is of course anisotropic, and you can detect this anisotropy in transport, and this has, for example, been done by Byung-hee Hong in Korea in one of his recent papers as well. Another way to describe this, the effect of deformations in the band structure, is by considering this, the so-called effective gauge fields, or pseudo gauge fields. And the process is very simple. You have a hopping, which now can change arbitrarily in space. And if the perturbation to these hoppings is not large, one can treat this perturbatively. So essentially, we consider this as a perturbation. And we do, then you do the usual Dirac approximation around the K points. And you find that you get from this isotropic piece of the Hamiltonian, you get sigma dot p, which is your Dirac equation. But this perturbation here leads to a new term, which has vector nature, and couples just like a magnetic field would couple through this vector potential. But this A vector is nothing more than a weighted linear combination of the perturbations in the hoppings to the nearest neighbors. So, this has been described by several authors. There's an interesting review was already pointed out by Marco about this, by Maria and Paco and Katz Nelson about these effects of these gauge fields. But the thing is that if you have something, so now you have this gauge field here, and if you consider that you have this perturbation is slowly varying in space, you can easily see that what's happening more or less roughly is that the Dirac, the position of the Dirac cone is changing depending on where you are. So because essentially if you treat this as approximately constant, the Dirac cone will be changing from place to place. So essentially, the Fermi surface is shifted from the K point to K minus this gauge field. This is just to repeat that since this couples as a magnetic field, you can, in principle, extract this pseudo magnetic field, which the electrons will feel as essentially, if it were a magnetic field. The only difference is that you have time reversal symmetry, which is which manifests itself in the fact that the K point and the K prime point have opposite signs for this field. But otherwise, this acts as a magnetic field and it leads to lambda levels and so on and so forth. So. The idea is then, why don't we use, since we can, we know that there is this, we can describe this in terms of this spatially varying gauge fields, why don't we tailor spatial strain profiles to get specific functionalities? And again, as I said before, the key thing is that, unlike in other materials, the fact that we have a 2D system where you can interact with it with many different ways, even put it out of plane, and so on, and it's robust, allows this in principle and in practice as well, which, you know, I'll discuss in further. And essentially, the idea is to tailor more or less like, you know, you would do with conventional lithography. You can tailor, you can define regions of graphene, you can cut and define different device regions, quantum dots, ribbons, contacts, and so on and so forth. The idea is to do that, but without cutting graphene. Rather, you know, you try to manipulate the strain in specific regions in ways that are, you know, compatible with certain behavior that you want the electrons to feel. So this is essentially the content of the strain engineering concept: explore local strain configurations to design specific functionalities. The simplest example I can think of is this one. Again, this is just a recap of the previous slide. You have this gauge field, and the simplest situation is when you have a region of graphene which is uniaxially stretched with respect to the rest. And in this region, the Fermi, you know, the Dirac cone will be shifted with respect to its position in this region. And this will cause some resistance towards electro flow through this region. And this translates into, you know, a transmission amplitude which can be cut off beyond certain angles, beyond certain energies. So, for example, it's shown here that beyond a certain angle of momentum with respect to this barrier region, you can totally suppress transmission. If you apply a gate in the same region, in addition to shifting, to translating the Dirac cone, you can also shrink the Fermi surface, because if you apply a gate, you move it up and down, not only in the plane. So this gives you further freedom so that you can select a piece from the other region of this plot, and in a sense you can select by manipulating the gate and the amount of strain, you can select which sector of incoming or alternative which energy values are allowed to tunnel through this region. Essentially, this comes from a very simple phase space argument. The two Fermi surfaces are shifted, and since you have to conserve momentum along this direction, this means that you have only the momenta within this sector are allowed to transmit. But the interesting point is that this piece of graphene here is uniformly strained, but it still has a Dirac dispersion, and so on and so forth. So this piece of the cone here, which is not overlapping with the cone in the bulk, also supports, you know, Dirac fermions, but they will be confined, and that's actually what you find. So you find a combination of regions where you have transmission resonances with regions where you have confinement, and this is essentially just a consequence of the fact that you have these two shifted Dirac cones, and you have to conserve momentum. And this leads to either confined modes or transmission resonances. And since this is a confinement problem, the energy scale is exactly the same that you have in a graphene nanoribbon. So the level spacing and so on and so forth. And you can even have zero energy modes if you imagine that you can fine tune a zigzag strain deformation like this, and so on and so forth. So another interesting consequence of this is that you can easily imagine that if you strain enough, or if you reduce the density enough so that the two Fermi surfaces don't overlap at all, you would have no tunneling, because there's no possibility, you cannot possibly conserve momentum along this direction. And in fact, this has been shown explicitly by Fogler, Kinnear, Katz, Nelson, that essentially when you integrate the transmission amplitude that I showed before over all directions, you can get the conductance. And beyond a certain strain or below a certain density, you actually get a gap, because, you know, if you start reducing the density here, these Fermi surfaces will be smaller and smaller, and so they don't overlap. So there's no way that the electrons can tunnel through. And so you can, in fact, generate a transport gap without having a spectral gap in graphene. So essentially, one of the problems in around this concept of strain engineering is that it's okay. It's easy to, if you have a deformation, go to renormalize the hoppings, from them get the gauge fields, and from there get defective magnetic fields. But ideally, we want to go the opposite way. We want, because it's easy to, given a magnetic field, preferably constant, we know how the electrons behave, and we want to, given a magnetic field profile, what would be the deformation that corresponds to that. So there is an inverse problem here, which is not so trivial. And you know, Paco made an interesting and important contribution to that, essentially showing that if you have an overall trigonal symmetry to a deformation, then you get predominantly constant effective magnetic field. But people really started paying attention to strain graphene essentially after these experiments by Cromie. He didn't talk about them in the morning, but essentially what has been shown here, what has been reported, is that there's, under some conditions, you can have bubbles in graphene grown by CVD on top of metals, and if you scan an STM along these bubbles, which have, again, this accidental trigonal symmetry, you can see some resonances. And now, if you map the index of these resonances against the, you know, the square root of this index against their position, you get a straight line. This is what you would expect if you have Landau levels in graphene. So from here, you can extract the effective pseudomagnetic field, and the number was big. So this is you know, it's quite interesting. This has actually been reported afterwards by other groups, and essentially the result is the same. Here is an interesting approach to try to do this in a more controllable way, because that's the key, in a sense. One wants to do this controllably, and here this Japanese group tries to do that by placing graphene sheet on top of nanopattern silicon nanopillars, and they, you know, they report they can have strains of these magnitudes. So this is one of first approach to try to get control over the strain distribution in graphene. I want to advertise a little bit some unpublished data from a colleague of mine at NUS that they have interesting results now on graphene grown on ruthenium. And in graphene grown on ruthenium, it shows this super lattice structure with a well-defined moiré, which is more or less well understood. But the key point is that the moiré is not just electronic density, it's also corrugation. So this is correlated. And so essentially what happens is that you, by certain means, you can promote the merging of some of these bumps into larger bubbles, okay? And you can do this in a controllable way, and you can do this in different shapes, like more symmetric and, you know, more hexagonal shape, more triangular. You can do this controllably, and you can essentially do the same thing, and you get, you know, effective fields of the order of, you know, 200, 350, 600, 450, and things like this. So this is quite promising in the sense that people are on the experimental side getting closer to try to get control over the spatial distribution of strain. And that's, of course, the key aspect of this strain engineering effort. So, for example, another interesting implication is that, for example, we can have consequences for optical absorption, or you could explore something into optical absorption, is that, of course, graphene has this well-known broadband optical absorption in the infrared. But when you deform graphene, in addition to displacing the Dirac point, if you do this again uniaxially, in addition to displacing the Dirac point, you also introduce anisotropy. In other words, you know, your Fermi surface is no longer a circle; it becomes anisotropic, and in fact, you can derive this effective, you know, Hamiltonian in this case, which now instead of being just sigma dot p is tau 1 times the longitudinal momentum with some longitudinal velocity and the second Pauli matrix times the transverse momentum and a different transverse velocity and to lowest order and in linear order in strain, they depend on strain like so. And for example, one can use this to see what happens to this to the optical absorption. It's more or less obvious what should happen. What you get is essentially summarized here. You get the isotropic frequency dependence of the conductivity corrected by these. And now, it of course, depends on which direction. So if you're talking about the longitudinal absorption or the transverse absorption, then you have a different sign here because on the direction which you stretch, in the direction along which you stretch, your Fermi velocity becomes smaller, and therefore, by virtue of the presence of the velocity matrix element here, and the absorption should become smaller as well. So here it is. So this is based on tight binding. And here the Dirac approximation, but here is a comparison with ab initio. So these curves are obtained from unrestricted ab initio, and what's plotted here is sigma yy against omega, and we're applying strain uniformly along the x and the y directions, which correspond to zigzag and armchair directions, and for example, here in the infrared region, where you expect roughly constant sigma of omega, you do see this renormalization. It's essentially linear in strain, and here's the inset shows basically what happens at this frequency of 1 electron volt, that you have a linear dependence with strain of this absorption. But the most interesting aspect is, to me, is what happens close to the Van Hove singularities. And there's several things happening. So one of them is, of course, that since the system becomes anisotropic, at the Van Hove singularity, you're at the end point, and at the end point has the full symmetry of the lattice. So if you start deforming, you'll inevitably split the Van Hove singularities. So that's what you see here along certain directions. Or rather, except for exceptional directions, you should in principle split the peaks, the Van Hove singularity. But what's interesting is that this splitting it's actually quite large. For example, you see here that it can bring the Van Hove singularity essentially by half for 10% strain, and this is quite interesting because there has been effort in trying to drive graphene towards the Van Hove singularity in hopes of stimulating and inducing correlations and interaction effects and so on and so forth. But this is, of course, very hard because you have to dope this a lot, and people have tried to do this. Barbaros tried to do this or with this ferroelectric gating. Philip Kim also did similar things. But it's difficult by doping because you have to really add a lot of electrons to the system. So maybe by using strain, you can put the Van Hove singularity closer to essentially halfway to the place where it lies usually, and you might eventually reach the Van Hove singularity more easily. And alternatively, you can think that you can use strain to bring graphene to and from the regime where possible correlations might exist. In other words, you can put graphene in a regime where the Fermi level lies close to the Van't Hoff singularity, but then if you change the amount of strain or if you remove the strain, you can drive it back to the original position. So you could turn on and off these effects and so on. So these are just some specific numbers for these values here. And since I'm just going to skip this, so this is another aspect that you could use the simple optical absorption to determine the amount of strain and direction of the strain in the lattice and so on and so forth. Other aspects of strain graphene include wrinkles and the fact that, and whether these wrinkles can scatter considerably or not electrons, and we have addressed a little bit of that, and it's also gives an interesting example of Dirac fermions, again in a curved surface where you can essentially describe the scattering of this of electrons by these objects. By manipulating strain, you can tune the chemical reactivity of graphene. This could be useful for many things. For example, so you could use strain and shear and so on to perhaps facilitate preferential attachment of ad atoms, or perhaps induce enhance spin orbit coupling in situations where you can induce regions of sp3 hybridization and so on and so forth. Many other things could be said about this, in particular the fact that if you explore anisotropy, you can always think that you go from two-dimensionally towards one-dimensionality, and in principle you should, by general arguments, you should expect that electron-electron interactions could become enhanced. That's one thing that's being worked on. And these are some other aspects of chemical reactivity. There are many things still to be done in the context of bilayer and strain bilayer. So I guess I conclude now. So essentially, the concept of strain engineering is now mainstream in the sense that people actively look into ways to implement these. There are many possibilities beyond what you can usually do in standard materials. The standing issues are, of course, the question of how to manipulate experimentally local strain with accuracy, and there are obvious challenges in when you induce this sort of systems. You have to transfer graphene to other substrates which are insulating, and there are challenges in how you preserve the strain profiles there. And also maybe some further theoretical approaches to this inverse problem could be useful in interacting with experiments towards better control of strain profile in real space. Thank you.
It seems when we make a gated graphene device, I think we most of us know sort of like what is the maximum amount that we can dope things electrostatically, mm-hmm. just from all the experience everyone has. But but a number that I don't know and always wonder is if I just cut a little hole in the dielectric and have the suspended graphene, then what is sort of the maximal amount of strain that I can induce just electrostatically with the gate? Is that sort of a number that you know, or that it's well known?
Actually, that's, you mean the maximum number that you can get before it breaks, or?
Yeah. In a normal device geometry, where
you can
gate the hell out of it.
How
much does it?
Essentially,
strain?
What happens is that you gate, you charge it, but this is suspended, so you start, there is electrostatic pressure, right? So it starts attracting to the gate, so on and so forth.
Yeah, so what's the most?
This has been described by Paco and Misha Fogler. And so essentially, you can The question, I mean, I don't know how much you can stretch. In principle, you could stretch as much if you have it clamped, and you keep increasing the gate voltage. Yeah, I don't know the number.
I want the number.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure. Yeah, sure. But I'm pretty sure that you. I mean, you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, never mind. Forget it.
You won't break.
That's what the theorists always say. Yeah. They say, yeah, yeah, it's easy. We all know, yeah, but no one will tell me the number.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, it won't break by.
That's not the number I was hoping for.
I think that it won't break for sure before. You cannot drive it to very large strains by gating. That's. I think that you cannot do that.
This is actually just to answer Mike's question. We have done some experiment on that. So it varies, depends a lot on the length of the area. So what we have is about 2 micron to 3 micron long trench, and single layer graphene you can gate up to maybe 20 volt in gate voltage, assuming all your outsides are etched. And bilayer you can go maybe 30s, 3 layer can maybe go 45 if you are brief. So that's the kind of number, but I think it's pretty sensitive to the length, so it goes as some power of the length.
Yeah.
I think we got about one to two percent, but that, well, basically at high gate voltage, the charge start to become inhomogeneous distributed, and there is some instability. You just collapse the membrane.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, but even if you could clamp it and keep straining, I guess that's what Paco and Misha Fogler described in their paper. The amount of strain is not. I mean, it cannot be that much because you cannot gate. I mean, you have the electric breakdown of your entire system before you can reach, you know, like 5%, 1%, something like this.
No more questions. Let's thank the speaker.